Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and our special guest Phil Hammond. We are here for, there's going to be an election at some point, an NHS pre-election special which will become relevant at some point in the next 10 months, we are assuming. So, Phil, we wanted to ask you all sorts of questions. Adam's got a growth that he wants you to look at.
It's cancer and you'll be dead in a fortnight. Oh,
right. No, we just thought it would be fun to get you in, kind of like a reverse What's My Line? That's a good reference for the younger listeners there.
Keeping it real.
Absolutely, yeah. But Phil, you are MD, as listeners of this podcast will know already. We wanted to get you in, ask you, first of all, you've written something really interesting recently about privatisation, and there's a lot of discussion of NHS privatisation. Is it being privatised by stealth? Is it not? What's your take on it?
Well, the particular article I wrote, I was sent a leaked email from the president of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists, who was making the point that over 50% of cataracts are now done by private providers, and often it won't go anywhere near an NHS GP. So you can go to Specsavers now, and they pick up you've got a cataract, and they can refer you to a private provider. The issue there is that some of the private providers have links to Specsavers and other private companies. And so, as with all private medicine, there's a vested interest in over-treating you, treating you too early, giving you three cataract operations when you only need one. And the other issue with the outsourcing of work to the private sector is that they've tried to change this, but generally there isn't an obligation to do training of NHS staff. So if all the cataracts are done in the private sector and we're not training future ophthalmologists, then who's going to do it? So you cherry-pick the easy cases, you make your profit, but there's no duty on you to train. And that bit is missing as well. But whether that means privatisation depends on how you define privatisation. If you say this is taxpayers' money and contracted out to the private sector, some people will say that's not privatisation.
So cataract operations, as I understand it, your lens gets cloudy.
Yeah.
And it's a relatively simple operation. They take that out and they put in a replacement.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that the reason that's such easy pickings for privatisation is because it's day surgery, it's relatively uncomplicated, you can do it at volume.
Yes.
Is it a kind of unique case, or might we see the same kind of thing happening with other... Are there other surgeries?
No, well, the thing that's been going on the longest, probably, that has been going on for so long we don't talk about, is private psychiatric care. It's been going on for years, and some of the most serious cases are outsourced to the private sector, and the Royal College of Psychiatrists president talked to The Guardian podcast recently and said we'd be lost without the private sector. They're sort of codependent on each other. We've been reliant on them for so long. If you suddenly said we weren't going to use the private sector of psychiatry, the NHS would be completely stuffed. So that's the issue. You might say, in my heart, I want all public services to be publicly funded and public provided and publicly accountable. The reality of the situation is that we've been outsourcing to the private sector for so long now. If we suddenly pulled up the drawbridge, waiting lists would go through the roof, and that's clearly not something that Labour would contemplate. So whether ideologically you think it's a good idea or not, it's happened for a long time, and it's probably here to stay. My argument is if you're going to do it, at least make the private sector do some training or pay a levy for training, because they're using generally our NHS doctors working privately to do the work, and we need to train the next lot of junior doctors because they're really angry at the moment, if you hadn't noticed.
I've got another basic question just before we get into any future ones. So with the example you give of Specsavers recommending you go to a private provider, how's that recorded? Does that get into statistics of people who've had cataracts?
Yes.
Okay, so it's known.
Yes, because it's NHS. It's private treatment on the NHS, but that's included in the statistics, which is why the president of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists could say, whatever he said, 56% of cataracts are now done outsourced to the private sector.
And I, as the patient, am paying for that? Or it's the NHS paying privately for it?
Yes.
So the NHS pays for it, but they're paying maybe a higher rate because it's your ophthalmologist or your surgeon is being paid a higher rate because they're working privately.
No,
okay.
Not necessarily a higher rate. In the old days when Labour introduced this, because they were desperate to, this is under Tony Blair, they were desperate to encourage new entrants into the market, they gave the private sector guaranteed contracts whether they did the work or not. It's a bit like PFI. PFI was a terrible deal that gave us huge mortgages. These days, actually, we're a bit more savvy. There's much less of a purchaser-provider split now. Simon Stevens sort of got rid of that, but there still are these contracts. And the profiteering is probably less than it used to be. But you would argue that the private sector take the easy cases that aren't going to need an NHS intensive care unit. They're not people with loads of multi-morbidities or whatever. So they take the easy stuff and they're able to make a profit. But it's not as hideous profiteering as it used to be.
Okay.
And that happens with lots of outsourcing generally, where the kind of easier bits get cherry-picked off by the private sector and therefore deeply flatters the private sector. And people say, why is the public sector so unbelievably inefficient? And it's, as you were saying, lots of people with really difficult comorbidities, or they're doing more high-risk work or whatever it might be. And it just, it makes it very hard to compare like for like.
It does. And that's the other thing that needs to happen. If something goes tits up in a private operation and they need to come back to an NHS intensive care unit, the private sector should pay for that. And in the past, it hasn't always. It's used the NHS as a safety net for when its operations occasionally go tits up.
Is the problem the one that an awful lot of private eye stories eventually seem to come back to, is that the people we've got in the public sector who are negotiating these contracts seem to be about as efficient as kind of candidates on The Apprentice? I mean, I would say the lead story we've got in the last issue was about Frank Hester, you know, the Tory party's pet racist at the moment. But the figures in that are just absolutely eye-watering. The contracts he had with the NHS, you're talking about a company's pre-tax profits of 48 million on a turnover of 76 million. I mean, that is doing very, very well. It's not surprising he's got tens of millions to splash around on the Tory party.
Yes, I think that's true. And of course, we saw that during the pandemic with all the PPE fast lane to mates kind of thing. I mean, people will say it was desperate times, prices were very high. The NHS has a sad history of not negotiating with public money terribly wisely. But I come back to the original point, is we have waiting lists of 7-8 million now, and I can't see any particular quick way of getting them down without involving the private sector. Although the Times has had a health commission, and one of their recommendations is to have these hubs that work continuously round the clock over certain weekends. You take a big unit and they'll do round the clock stuff to do a massive amount of hernias or cataracts or something to try and make an inroad into the private sector. And
kind of like a changing rooms or ground force thing, where you've got 24 hours to fix as many hernias as
you can. They do that in India. They have mass heart surgery, mass hernias, mass whatever. Yeah. And actually, people who will come to this aren't necessarily fully qualified doctors, but just do hernias or something. They're good with their hands, and they were good at carpentry at school or something. So sometimes in some of the Indian places, they're not necessarily all their technicians who've learnt to do, or their nurse practitioners who've learnt to do endoscopies, hernias, whatever. Okay. So that's another interesting point.
Big question, does that work? Does it?
I mean, it seems to, yeah.
Okay.
But that's all they're doing.
Right, yeah, yeah. So in terms of the argument about privatisation by stealth, all of this, as Helen asks, is this going to go further? Is it the next easy operation? Is the knee operations, which all get farmed out to the private sector? Because that's a big concern for lots of people.
It's already happening. It's already happened. So the Royal United Hospital, where I live in Bath, has taken over the local Circle Hospital, which is now called Sulis. And they use that, and a lot of its operations are done there. So it's already happening. And even there are quite a few consultants who have shares in private companies. They've set up their own concerns. And
is that allowed?
Yes, I think so. And they can refer patients to private consortia that they have a financial vested interest in.
Is that allowed?
Well, what it should happen is you should declare it to the patient. So the one thing, I think private providers are here to stay, but the patient should know and be told perfectly clearly whether it's a private provider or not. So what happened in the past is private providers used the NHS logo when they were providing private services. And some people complain saying, I don't want to. I think fundamentally it's wrong to outsource to the private sector and I don't want to be treated there and you must tell me. So I think that's the issue. We've just got to be honest with people and say, look, we're in such a mess with waiting lists. We're having to outsource to the private sector, but we will tell you. And if you choose not, you can. I think that's the best we're going to get in the foreseeable future.
In terms of the actual costs, just on a practical level, so my experience this recently was taking my dad not for a cataract operation, for a complication he had after his cataract operation, which he had in an NHS high hospital. I've written this down because I can't pronounce it. Posterior capsular opacification, which apparently is something that happens quite often after cataract things. He was given the option of kind of three different places where he could have this and told that the shortest waiting list was at a private clinic. It was the most extraordinary experience. It had huge leather sofas. It had a real log fire in the in the waiting room. It was so impressive. Did it cost the NHS more for my dad to have that very brief laser surgery done there than it would have done to have it done at the NHS High Hospital?
I don't know. Possibly. I mean, that's one of the things I believe, is that you should be able to follow the money. We should publish all this and you should know precisely. You should be presented with a bill at the end of the day for precisely what your NHS care cost. Not that you're paying for it, but just out of interest. This is what the GP thing costs. This is what that costs. This is what going to the private hospital have the complication. But I don't know. It's pretty opaque at the moment. So it's possible it could have been. But it's worth pointing out, if you look at the ONS latest figures on health spend in the UK, there's quite a chunk of private health spend. So they look at total health spend when they compare us to other European countries, and we're spending whatever it is in England, maybe 150, 160 billion on the NHS, and there's about 40 billion spend on private. Lots of people are doing pay-as-you-go. That's the biggest chunk of it, and there's a bit on insurance. So already within the NHS, it's not just the NHS, the private sector is a significant provider of private practice, as well as doing NHS work as well. So they're doing really well out of the waiting list.
What we're talking about there is people taking themselves out because they want to pay for their own chemotherapy
But if you were told, you know, you had a really unpleasant hernia or something, you were told it was going to be 2 years on the NHS, and you had the money to go privately, you'd probably go privately.
Things like hip operations, knee operations, things that are grindingly unpleasant on a day-to-day basis but aren't fundamentally going to finish you off. Those are the waiting lists that are really long. Right?
And it's not just the pain, it's the fact that you're economically unproductive. The bit that the Tories never really understood is that investing in the NHS is investing in the economy because you get people back to work quicker.
And that is a problem we've really got, particularly post-COVID. The number of economically inactive people, I think in the 50 to 64 bracket particularly, you know, people maybe coming towards the end of their careers, but they still, in other circumstances, would have a lot of good years left of working, just not now economically active at all, is a huge drain. And I think the other thing is that you're right about being more transparent about the money would really help. There was some interesting recent polling about would you pay higher taxes for the NHS? And this is a problem for the Conservatives because the people who by and large said yes, they would, were older people who use it more. Mm. People aged 25 to 30 often don't have that much contact with the NHS. If you don't have kids yet and you're a healthy 20-something, you don't actually see a lot of the NHS. And those are the people who think, well, why should I be paying for this?
The trouble is with a limited tax take, there's always an opportunity cost. So if you're putting more into the NHS, that's money that could have gone into education. If you ask me what gives you the biggest bang for your buck over the years, I'd say put it in education. There's a lot of evidence. The better educated you are, the healthier you are, and the less reliant you are in the future. But that manifests itself over 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And the thing we've always failed at, prevention, everyone's talking about prevention now, but prevention is A, boring, B, generally silent. It's the dog that doesn't bark, so you don't know when you prevent a stroke or a heart attack. And it requires about a 10 or 20 year view that no political party has ever had. So if we're serious about prevention, every party, we've got to have a cross-party support for a 20-year getting us all healthier plan, and we've never had that yet. And actually, that's the main reason why waiting lists are so high. About 70% of the illness, or at least 50%, is potentially avoidable, preventable with better lifestyle.
It's also quite intensive, isn't it, prevention? I mean, I've been doing some work on Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, the new class of GLP agonist drugs that are the weight loss drugs, essentially. Mm. And you talk to doctors about them, some of them have concerns, but some of them also say, it is for the first time I have something that actually works. We used to have people come into the surgery and we'd say, your BMI is 30, your life expectancy is much longer, your quality of life would be much better if you could lose that weight. And then the thing is, please come back when you've lost it. And almost no one ever did because it's really, really hard to do.
But, and they do work and the drugs are promising, but they're not the answer. The answer is it's a social problem and we need moving up the chain and looking at the corporate determinants of health, such as what the food industry does to put this highly calorific shite in our food chain in the first place and advertise. You know, you see, I was talking to Claire Gerada the other day, who I'm doing a show at Edinburgh with, and she came out of her surgery watching kids come out of school. And all of them went out of school and went to a shop and bought a highly calorific snack straight out of school. And she reckoned each one was about 2,000 or 3,000 calories. It's massive, great lumps of sugary shite. And that's happening day in, day out. Kids coming out of school having a big mouthful of sugary shite and then going home. And it's, you know, until you move upstream and stop that, yes, the new drugs are encouraging, but we need to move up.
I think it's a really interesting point you made about being presented with a bill, because you end up with no idea of how much any sort of treatment actually costs. I still remember, it was George Osborne, wasn't it, who came in and said, you know, every year with your tax bill, you're going to get a sort of breakdown of what it's being spent on. Mm. But actually, there's kind of...
You do get that now. Mm. You can go to HMRC website. And the one of the scary things is that now repaying the national debt is 12% because interest rates are so high. Yeah. That's really gone up. But yeah, I think you're right. It's the same thing. When you look at Americans who obviously have to pay things out of pocket, you know, simple admission to accident and emergency is running into the tens of thousands. Perhaps I'm not sure that...
Simple. I mean, prescription costs are standardised, so you have no idea whether the pills you're paying for are costing the NHS, you know, thousands of pounds or thousands of pennies.
It's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, I live in a fairly affluent area and I see people coming out of the surgery who I know are very wealthy, retired with a massive, huge, great carry bag full of prescription drugs. And you know that they could afford to pay for them. We know that the administration of taking away free prescriptions is, and it's politically unpalatable, but it's really interesting that You know, some people get an absolute bargain off the NHS, and some have, you know. There should be some way of making a voluntary contribution back to the NHS, saying, look, I've just gone to the doctors, I've got 4,000 quid's worth of prescriptions to get me through the next month.
But it's like the winter fuel payment.
I'm going to give you a couple of hundred. Yes, the same thing should apply.
The triple lot pension, that actually politically this would be so incredibly difficult, and means testing is kind of anathema to everyone. Yeah.
But they'd argue they've paid in. And they'd argue they've paid in. They might have paid in higher taxes, and they've probably paid for a good chunk of the drugs they're carrying out. I would imagine would be their point.
Exactly what their argument would be, but
that means the younger generation can just really look forward to some really good drugs in old age. That's you're paying in now, you're going to get the benefit.
So, Phil, can I check? I would love to know how bad I should feel. Let's say I need something done on my hip. I've got the money to pay for it. I get the operation done on my hip. What have I dodged there, or have I made things worse for someone else by doing that?
By going private, you mean?
Yeah, by going private. I'd love to know, because my life is mostly working out how bad I should feel about various things.
Okay.
And so tell me, please.
It's not as simple. Even Jeremy Hunt, lovely Jeremy Hunt, who we've all got to know and love, wrote this book called Zero, about zero avoidable harm in the NHS. And he says very clearly in there, outsourcing to the private sector isn't the answer, because it's the same staff that are serving the NHS, generally, particularly the consultants, not always the nurses who are also treating you. So it doesn't cut the waiting list as much as you think. Thatcher always used to say, she had a Dupuytren's done, she stood outside the private hospital and said, I encourage people to go private to take the pressure off the NHS if you can afford it. But it's not as simple as that, largely because it's the same staff. If we had loads of doctors and you had separate doctors privately in the NHS, it would be different. But at the moment, yes. But having said that, if I was in terrible pain from hip arthritis and it was a 2-year waiting list, I'd pay to go private.
Right.
And feel slightly guilty. But I'm hopeless with pain, as many men are.
Another thing we should talk about is the staffing levels and situation and everything in the NHS. And one thing that you've written about recently, Phil, is this actually not that new position of physician associates. This is a class of staff in the NHS. They were introduced in the early 2000s. Basically, they are not doctors. They don't prescribe drugs, they don't prescribe x-rays, but they are able to do things like they can order various tests, they can conduct examinations, develop treatment plans. The idea is that they work with doctors, and there are a few thousand of them, and there might be more soon.
Yeah, the NHS plan wants to rapidly accelerate the number of them, but the key takeaway is they're not doctors, and they need to be supervised, and in that context, they're really helpful. If they're out on their own, I would say a bit more dangerous. I know some operating department assistants who work brilliantly for ages, who've become anaesthetic PAs and are brilliant. And my consultant colleagues say they're indispensable, because they worked in theatres for ages and now they're doing this and they have a certain defined role, and they are indispensable to the running of our unit. But often they're people who've had science degrees and decide they want to do it, and it's generally a 2-year degree now, but they're also going to do some on-the-job training as well.
They're kind of like paralegals, to borrow from another industry. They are not doctors,
but
they are medically trained in certain
areas.
They used
to be called physician assistants. The doctors and the Royal College and the doctors liked when they were physician assistants, because that made it clear that they were assisting the doctor.
Right.
The name then changed to a physician associates, and this is where it's all got slightly murky. They're not supposed to prescribe, and they're not supposed to order ionising radiation x-rays. But because the NHS is so short-staffed, there have been issues where they've been put in positions where they're seeing undifferentiated patients. So what's supposed to happen is you as a doctor say, look, I'm going to triage this, and this patient I think is relatively uncomplicated, and the physician associate's going to see them for us. Because there's shortages of doctors and strikes and all the rest of it.
Is that another condition that might apply to? Are we talking sort of,
people will always say sepsis, won't they? So if you're saying, I've seen this and I think this is a straightforward tonsillitis or something, and I think you can deal with this, then in general practice you triage. But if it's something a bit more complicated and you're worried it might be sepsis or whatever, that's something a GP should see, a doctor should see.
Because that's blood poisoning, that can escalate very quickly to fever.
Yeah, but the trouble is you can't always spot these things, and there's loads of examples that I've had in my life where I thought something was relatively trivial and it turned out to be really serious. So you can't always predict. It's come to a head because very belatedly the government has come up with a staffing plan for the NHS, which it should have done 75 years ago. And it's trying to accelerate through the number of physician associates. We're going to increase them to 5 or 10,000 or whatever in 10 years' time.
And we should say, for listeners who are also not familiar, there are at the moment about 3,000.
Yeah.
Not very many across the whole
NHS. No, and they're trying to accelerate them as part of their plan, which is fine. But you need a commensurate acceleration in doctors, particularly the doctor who's going to train and supervise them. Now, doctors in training are already saying, we don't get enough training and supervision, and they're nicking our training opportunities. Now, because they hate the government and they don't trust them, they say, what I think is happening here is that they're these physician associates are going to be used as doctors on the cheap. So there's some evidence now that the government is scaling back a bit on its desire to train far more medical students and have doctors, because it's thinking, we're putting 500,000 quid in and the buggers are going to Australia. So you can bugger off. We're not going to train more of you. We're just going to have physician associates. So it's going to... What we learnt, interestingly, in the junior doctor strike is that the more senior person you see at the front door, the better treatment you get. So rather ironically, when the consultants had to come in and cover the junior doctors, emergency patients often got better care because you had a more experienced person making critical decisions in short spaces of time. If you flip that up and you say you have physician associates, the least experience with the less training... Seeing undifferentiated patients, that's likely to lead to avoidable harm and error. But the thing I don't like about it is it's got really unpleasant. People are warring within themselves. There are physician associates who've gone off sick with depression and whatever. Right. And the whole atmosphere is horrible. With an election coming on and strikes up, it's being politicised in a way that isn't particularly compassionate.
Some people saying these people are not proper doctors, they shouldn't be allowed near patients, or they're not trained enough.
Well, they're clearly not proper doctors, and they're not pretending to, although people are discovering bits where a physician associate has ordered an X-ray or done this. So there's people who've kept logs where physician associates have gone beyond their role.
Right, but I think they are instructed to say, I'm not a doctor. Yes. I'm a physician associate. I can help with these certain things.
Yeah.
And they do say that to patients.
So then the next issue is who's going to regulate them. They weren't initially going to be regulated, and then they were going to be regulated, and then the General Medical Council has taken it on, and doctors saying no. If the GMC does it, they're going to be further confused with doctors. And I think somebody else should be regulating them.
It's a very interesting, delicate issue, isn't it? Because there is a sense of, particularly the BMA, that about doctors as a kind of guild, and not exactly a closed shop, because obviously you have to go through a lot of training. But balancing the fact that doctors can be quite resistant to change because they see change inevitably as someone trying to dumb stuff down and bring in people. But it's really interesting. At the moment we're talking, there are two plays on in London, Nye at the National Theatre with Michael Sheen as Nye Bevan, and The Human Body at the Donmar, both of which are about the creation of the NHS and doctors' opposition to it fundamentally, and the fact that they had to be really talked into it. And I think some of these discussions are quite hard to have, because I think even sort of saying that some doctors are resistant to physician associates will put some people's backs up. But that is part of the story, isn't it? And not for ridiculous reasons, but there is a tendency, I think, particularly as you say, when doctors feel so at odds with the government, of feeling very resistant to change because you assume really that all change is going to be bad.
Yes. I mean, I would rather, as a medical workforce, we united and we welcomed nurse practitioners and people at all roles of different things doing different jobs. The issue is how do we train them properly and supervise them? And that's a fair point. There was an emergency general meeting at the Royal College of Physicians the other day, only the third in its history, where they debated this. And the motion that there will be a vote on possibly by the time the next eye goes out is to whether there should be a pause in this rollout. And the difficulty is...
physician associates.
Yes, yeah. And particularly, and the Royal College of Physicians has a vested interest because they're being paid to do the training and evaluation. So they're doing the educational program for them.
Right.
So if it was paused or reversed, they'd lose a lot of money. Okay. So there's a really interesting spat going on. The fellows of the Royal College of Physicians. But it's interesting because it hasn't really percolated much into the mainstream media because people they just want to be treated by someone. But I think there's a danger that if they're not properly supervised, they will dumb down. But when they are properly supervised, they're indispensable and a brilliant part of the team. So,
Are we not in danger of hitting the same problem that we had before? In that if we train up thousands and thousands of these physician associates, they'll do the same thing. They'll all bugger off to Australia where they can get better paid as well.
Possibly. I think that's possible. I don't know what the market...
Learning from history might be an idea.
Just look in the back of the BMJ for the... I mean, clearly, whatever we do to the NHS and social care, and let's say there are more vacancies in social care than there are in the NHS, and that's probably just as important to sort that out. But whatever we do, we have to make working in health and social care a more attractive proposition. If we're going to retain people, we've got to make it a better place to work for all sorts of reasons, and that's part training, part supervision, part how stressful the job is, et cetera, et cetera.
As someone whose doctor relatives have, in fact, buggered off elsewhere to Australia and New Zealand, I think one of the issues is you just get paid a lot more as a doctor elsewhere. So part of this story is a story about cost, right? So this is about trying to fill those roles and trying to offer, if you've only got a very tight pool of doctors and not very much to pay them, it makes sense, And I'm not sure the pressure is quite so acute on the Australian health system. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, and they're probably a bit fitter than we are. And there's a fair amount of obesity in Australia and obviously lots of skin cancer. But it's interesting to see how this plays out. So it could be that all the junior docs are really angry about the conditions at the moment. The ones who stay in the UK end up saying, I don't want to work in the NHS. I'm just going to work privately. We still have to scour countries who need doctors and nurses more than we do to nick their doctors and nurses, and they'll be providing the bulk of NHS care. Right. And we really will have a two-tier service. There's a possibility that that may happen as well, that people say, I just don't find the NHS safe to work in, it doesn't support my work-life balance, I can't afford a house in London. So as soon as I can get my qualifications, I'm going to prioritise my private work and do as little NHS work as possible. That may happen if they say, you know, you're not going to even restore our pay to what it was in 2010, I'm not going to work for you.
Right.
They're that militant. And fair play to them, I say. I probably would have been like that at that stage.
But to give people an idea of the figures, for a newly qualified doctor who's done 5-6 years of training, taken on, will be now repaying that when they get to a certain level at 9% of their income. The London salaries for that junior doctor, even once you have London waiting, are really not that much more than the UK average median wage of any sort, are there? They're, and never mind the idea of buying a house in London where the average house price is, you know, £500,000. Yeah. I think people get very confused because I think senior doctors do earn what is a competitive professional wage, but the first couple of years of your practice as a junior doctor are really seriously tough.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I think I'm getting older and I want there to be a health service for me as I get older. And it's, you know, I know, for example, I know Adam Kay fairly well, and I know lots of consultants who took their kids to go and see him in the hope that he would put them off a career in medicine. So he's the one who's really anti now, saying, oh, this is just terrible, because he's given up. He's saying, oh, bloody hell, just
this
get out.
Adam Kay wrote this, yeah, is going
Adam
to
Kay,
hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
Just and, become and, an enormously successful memoirist instead of going into medicine.
Exactly.
Played by Ben Whishaw.
But that's the trouble, is that we need doctors, and everything, because of the election and because of the strikes, we're accentuating the negative to such an extent. How are we going to attract people? And there's evidence that nursing applications and medical school applications are going down, because there's relentless wall-to-wall, this is a shite job. And it's not a shite job. It's actually a really rewarding job. I mean, I survived it by doing it part-time, so I'm a bit of a cheat. But I did this podcast recently for the BBC called Doctor Doctor, where I particularly sought out people who'd worked in the NHS all their lives and enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And some of them were younger, to be fair. So we need that voice as well. I'm not saying health and social care is shite. It is an amazing job. But yes, we need to reward people better and retain them and give them better living conditions.
So essentially, Charlie Fairhead, who's just left Casualty after 38 years.
Get him back.
Pretty atypical.
No, Sister Duffy, she was another one, wasn't she, in Casualty?
Yeah, they killed her off, though.
Did they?
Well, maybe we should counterbalance that with the another recent piece of yours, which was about whistleblowing and what it's like in the NHS if you do spot harm being done, or whether it's malpractice or mispractice, whatever it is, you tend to have a pretty unpleasant time, I believe.
You can do, again, a bit like prevention, isn't it? You don't see the cases that have gone right. So there might be cases all across the NHS where people listen to concerns and they act on them, and they're sorted out and you never hear about them. So the trouble with the stories that reach private eye or reach the media, they're generally stuff that's gone wrong. Mm. And the thing that's probably gone wrong is that the Public Interest Disclosure Act was never quite fit for purpose, in that you had to prove that you'd been discriminated against or suffered victimisation as a result of your whistleblowing, which could have been miles down the line. And the trust hospital, it's generally a hospital, could always afford 10 KCs or a huge number of barristers, and you were left either representing yourself, or I know one bloke, whistleblower we covered in the Eye, who had a bit of legal insurance on his household insurance, so he got, you know, legal representation at his employment tribunal.
Oh, great.
But what they tend to do is, if they don't want to answer the concerns, they'll counter-investigate you. They'll find errors in your work. They'll say, the reason you're raising these concerns is not that they're genuine. It's because you're trying to cover up deficiencies. You're a difficult person to work with. It's an employment issue. We're going to suspend you. We're going to give you 40 erroneous reports to the GMC, and we'll see you at the employment tribunal. Now, I'm not saying that's widespread, but there's enough of it happening to say that we still haven't. I mean, things will always go wrong in healthcare because it's so fast-moving and complicated and difficult, and we still haven't cracked the nut of owning up early to errors and trying to nip them in the bud. And maybe part of that is because the managers are saying, well, look, you know, we're 20 nurses down or we're 15 doctors down, and you're blowing the whistle about short-staffing and people dying in the back of ambulances, but I can't do anything about that, so I'd rather cover it up than see it on the front page of the local newspaper. So I have some sympathy. Because every year we know, for example, finance managers cook the books. They're given a ridiculous plan by NHS England to balance their books, and they come up with something that's absolute bollocks. It's a lie. And then basically towards the end of the financial year, we suddenly realise it's a lie, and they're suddenly, you know, 2 million in debt. And there still isn't the honesty within the NHS to say, lots of people are being harmed avoidably. We're going into debt because we're overloaded, and the best way just to give us an easy life is to try and cover it up and silence the whistleblowers. And that's still happening, yeah.
I mean, I think that the new NHS England guidance came out on puberty blockers for gender non-conforming children last week. And to me, that is, apart from anything else, once you put aside the kind of noisiness about it online, a story about whistleblowing. So David Bell, who was one of the staff governors, 10 staff came to him. So that's about a third of the people working in that very small Tavistock bit of the gender identity service there, and said, we've got concerns about this treatment and about the huge pressure of waiting lists, or the size of waiting lists ballooned. They felt a real pressure to get through cases. And, you know, it just took a lot of time for that to get through, and that message didn't really get through. This safeguarding lead Sonia Appleby won an employment tribunal about the fact she'd raised concerns as well. And, you know, it's kind of often presented in these very cultural terms, but fundamentally that is a story of intense NHS waiting list pressure and whistleblowing that wasn't attended to, because, as you say, there were other concerns. There were kind of, but we need to see these children are in genuine distress. No one's arguing about that. And we need to help them. So let's just keep running this train in the way we are, and not look about it and not think about the kind of all the stuff that's going on around it.
The thing that saddens me most about that is that whether it's gender blockers or not, you should not be using any drug anywhere in the NHS if you don't know what its long-term safety record is, if it hasn't been properly trialled, unless it's within the context of a randomised controlled trial that people have consented to. So whatever the drug was, we shouldn't have been using it in that context unless it was in a controlled trial and we could monitor what the effects were. You can't just say we're going to do it and then hopefully it'll be okay, and then suddenly you discover people can't have orgasms or et cetera, et cetera. It affects their brain development. We shouldn't have been using it in the first place in that context without it being as part of a controlled trial.
Right, so it was being, Lupron and these other drugs were being used off-label, essentially. Mm. So they, you know, there is a precocious puberty when a kid starts going through puberty at 8 or 9, and they were licensed, you know, for people had got an idea about that, but the idea was that then you went back to your puberty at the same time as all your classmates, and that you would obviously have your then puberty and your kind of in your natal sex. And it somehow migrated across to this very different use case, immediately followed by cross-sex hormones, which, as you say, when you block puberty at Tanner stage 2, really early on development, seem to affect both sexual function and also fertility. And the question then being, as you say, the Care Quality Commission rated the Tavistock inadequate for its records keeping because they just hadn't collected the data about what the long-term outcomes about this were. So, we at this moment, we can't really say what is the safety and efficiency of that treatment, because actually nobody really knows.
No. I used to say, I mean, I haven't really written about it, partly because I was working in a different era of paediatrics. I was working in ME/CFS, chronic fatigue, which is also has its issues. But I would see kids within that clinic who were thinking, weren't sure what their gender was, and I would say to them, you be as gender fluid as you like for as long as you like, but think very, very carefully before you outsource your gender either to the pharmaceutical industry or to a surgeon, because we don't know what the long-term outcomes are, and it may do far more harm than good, and you may regret it. But carry on being as gender fluid as you like. And occasionally you'd meet someone who did have a lot of interventions and treatment and surgery and stuff, and they'd be absolutely delighted. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you'd meet someone who would deeply regret it. So the issue then comes is how do you have enough time and therapy and understanding and an overloaded clinic with so many people to explore the issues and try and spot the people who will benefit from the people who won't benefit?
I think half the problem is it's taking place against such a febrile atmosphere. I thought it was really revealing that last week, when essentially this kind of considered guidance came through on the use of puberty blockers, Liz Truss, for God's sake, was also trying to introduce a private members bill in the Commons to ban them and add in sort of all of the other smorgasbord of culture war issues over that, of single-sex toilets and pronouns and all that kind of stuff. So it's quite hard to kind of detach the kind of the medical argument from the political, for want of a better word, argument.
Hilary Cass, who's a very senior paediatrician, was commissioned to carry out a report, and her interim version came out, and it said, yes, only as a randomised controlled trial. It now looks it might be even slightly more restricted even than that. But it was to address exactly that point that Phil said, which is, it would be very helpful to know whether or not this is a kind of a good idea, really. And as you say, you meet people on both sides of the divide, people very happy with their treatment, very unhappy with the treatment. You can't rely on anecdote in medicine. It has to be about data.
No, I think what's changed, I mean, the shift in the balance of power in medicine has been fascinating to me. When I first trained, we often wouldn't even tell patients their diagnosis. We'd use euphemisms, you're a bit flopsy-bunny, or it's time for a short walk back to the pavilion. So a third of patients weren't told they had cancer. We often wouldn't tell people they had motor neuron disease or multiple sclerosis. This is in the 80s. I mean, just imagine. Now, it's the pendulum has gone completely the other way, where people are self-labelling themselves. So they're not getting a diagnosis from the doctor. They're looking on the internet and they're saying, or they're seeing something on TikTok, they're saying, this is me. Mm. This is the label I'm appointing to myself, and I want a medical expert to sort it out. So by the time they reach the doctor, they've jumped the diagnosis stage because they've already done that for themselves. Mm. And whether that's right or wrong, it's creating a huge extra pressure on certain specialties. And it's something new.
And just one last thing on the staffing conditions for doctors. So one thing that Labour have certainly, I think they've said they support the idea, or maybe it's just Wes Streeting who said he supports the idea, is an independent office of the whistleblower. And Scotland adopted that last year, I believe. Are there any early indications as to how it's gone?
I don't know. I only found out recently that Scotland had adopted it, and I don't know what the answer is. I think what's needed, when we did The Messenger, which is now available on the Eye website with Andrew Bousfield in 2011.
Special report.
We said, yes, there should be something like an independent office of the whistleblower that gives them legal advice early to make sure that they're raising a disclosure in the public interest and they get proper legal advice. But the other thing, which I think is more important, is we called it an independent medical inspectorate, basically a crash investigation team that goes in for the most serious concerns raised by staff or patients and investigates really quickly. And it's free from the NHS Brotherhood, free from the Care Quality Commission. It's just there to pull the notes, look at it, see what's happened, and reach a judgment. If you did that early on, you wouldn't need to persecute your whistleblowers because someone would have come in really quickly and gone, boom, yes or no.
There's been a lot of discussion of things like that, hasn't there? The one that it's often compared to is airline safety and the kind of black box, because it's in everyone's interest, really, that airplanes do not fall out of the sky. But you wouldn't want to necessarily leave it to the airlines themselves to investigate it. But you could have a similar process in the NHS. And also to abstract it from a kind of question of blame, I guess, and to be a more of a learning exercise.
There is a lot to learn from the airline industry, but any health sector who says to me, we need to be more like the airline industry, they should be forced to pilot a plane with a hole in the fuselage, one of the wings missing, three members of crew down, and all the passengers have dementia, and then they'll have to land it in a busy thing with air traffic control on a sick break. The point that the patient safety people made is that a jumbo jet load of patients fall out of the sky in the NHS every week from potentially avoidable deaths. And we hardly bat an eyelid because we've become so desensitized to it. Whereas if it happens to a whole plane, you will shit yourself. There was a slightly mean phrase that was, if doctors died with their patients, they might take a bit more care. Just a little bit unfair. But there may be something
like
in some instance.
Where you get buried in the pyramid with your patient.
So I suppose the final thing we wanted to talk about with you, Phil, is you mentioned the health secretary a couple of minutes ago. What are you expecting or would like to see in manifestos as we head at some point towards the election? I think I've asked you this probably in 2019 and maybe in 2017 as well.
We must have done it for years, mustn't we? Same things, no majors, top-down reorganisation. Don't need any more of those.
Okay.
I wouldn't waste time arguing about the funding structure of the NHS. You know, I think that's a red herring. Tax-funded is fairest and easiest to administer. Mm-hmm. I like the focus on prevention, personally. Labour's gone for it. It's bottom-up, but it's a 10-year plan. It needs cross-party support and it won't get immediate results. The thing that worries me about Labour, Labour's published stuff in the most detail and they're doing the thing that Blair had to do. They're committing to reducing waiting times as well as committing to prevention. But the trouble is I'm not entirely sure that they can do both.
Right.
And we don't know whether they'll get a second term. If they want to promote prevention, you need at least two terms to see the results for that.
You've always been a prevention advocate.
Yeah, if I do, yes. Desmond Tutu, instead of pulling people out of the river, wander upstream and stop them falling in. But it's schools, houses, hospitals. 90% of prevention has nothing to do with the NHS. Decent housing, decent food. Give money to local governments as well as education so they can have playing fields. Mm. It's all that stuff. Not very sexy, but it's where the money needs to go, in my view.
It's a shame. I want to just end on this because I thought this might be upbeat, but I think Wes Streeting is certainly one of the ablest performers in that Labour shadow cabinet. But when you look at the structural problems of an ageing population, an overweight population, you know, all of those kind of things that, you know, the NHS, and also fundamentally go back to 1945, the NHS is just doing a lot more. You know, one of my colleagues at The Atlantic was just writing about the fact that cystic fibrosis, essentially, that was, you know, that used to be a death sentence
in
early childhood, and now we're people living well into adulthood. There have been these wonderful advances, but at the cost of expensive drugs. So the NHS is just being asked to do a lot of things it wasn't ever conceived to do.
We have done some good stuff. We've eradicated cervical cancer in Scotland using HPV vaccination. But the final thing to say is that they recently looked at, since 1960, life expectancy globally has increased by 19 years. Isn't that fabulous?
That's incredible.
But the proportion of your life lived healthily hasn't increased. Right. So the same proportion of people are living in ill health or with poor health. So what we've done is we've made a lot of people live longer, but half of them are living with diseases that previously would have killed them. So it's chronic disease that kills you. And it needs lifestyle change and decent house, decent hose.
Every time, Phil, you give with one hand and you take with the other.
Wait, because I remember something that Phil once said in a column, I think you wrote for me when I was at the New Statesman, which you said the best health advice you could say is get a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
So you go out for walks with it, so you get some exercise, you get someone to like talk to when there's no one else around. You've got a reason to kind of, you know, be up and about and
active. They look at you, your husband doesn't look at you, your partner doesn't look at you. And if you're too depressed to get your pants on in the morning, they lick your testicles. You don't get that at the doctors.
Right, I think we should stop this episode right now.
You should definitely report.
Did I say I was back at the Edinburgh Fringe? Can you put that in as well, please? Two shows at the Edinburgh Fringe.
You've been listening to Page 94. Thank you so much. I hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. Go and get a copy of the magazine and read more of these pearls of wisdom from Phil Hammond and all of his colleagues. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio, and we'll see you next time.